Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Great Lakes, surely one of the state's greatest assets. On today's show, we'll zero in on some key questions. What are the biggest threats to our lakes and just how should we manage them? And then we shift gears a little as we meet a man who wants to help local Michigan breweries one can at a time. But first, if you harbor hopes of living a long, healthy life, where you live in Michigan matters a lot. That's according to a report this week in Bridge magazine that hammers home the fact that we all probably deep down already know health and wellness is not evenly spread out in our state. Nowhere is that fact more starkly illustrated than the neighboring counties of Washtenaw and Wayne, where living on the right side of that county line means a longer life with better health. Contributing Bridge writer Ron French joins us now from Lansing. Welcome back to Stateside, Ron.
Good to be here.
So give us a sense of what it means in terms of health and wellness to be living on opposite sides of Rawsonville Road.
Well, if you live in Wayne County as opposed to Washtenaw County, you are about twice as likely to report being in poor or fair health. You are more likely to suffer from diabetes. You're more likely to have mental health issues. You're more likely to have a child die as an infant. And in the end, you are, if you are a male, likely to die 6 years earlier than your neighbors across the road in Washtenaw County.
You know, it just seems so hard to comprehend, such a major contrast on opposite sides of one county boundary.
That's what we found troubling, because you have two counties, both with a lot of resources, both with world-class medical facilities and wonderful doctors, any kind of specialist you could possibly want or need is within, a 10-minute drive, no matter where you live in either of those counties. Yet you have this massive difference between these two. And we found it instructive because it seemed to indicate that your health isn't just a matter of your health care.
So it's not a matter of hospitals and doctors.
Correct. There are parts of the state, Cynthia, where there are doctor shortages, but Wayne County is not one of them. So if you're looking at Wayne County and Washtenaw, you have to look beyond doctors and hospitals to try to get a sense what the problem is.
Well, you pointed out in your piece, Ron French, Wayne County has five of the state's top 10 ranked hospitals, and it is absolutely last in Michigan in terms of physical and mental health and low birth rate and premature death. So what are those core issues that you find that have even a bigger impact on our health than a matter of hospitals and doctors?
Right. A lot of it has to do before you show up in the doctor's office. A lot of it has to do with poverty and education. You find that health is correlated more closely with education and with your income than they are with how good your doctor is.
I would also imagine that your air and water makes a difference, and I'm saying this because we just recently spoke with a representative of the Delray District as we kind of explored what impact the new second bridge might have on the people that have been living in that industrial setting, and she referred to asthma rates that are unbelievable amongst children and adults. So the clean water and clean air issue?
Absolutely. That's a factor, too. There's not a major, major difference between Wayne and Washtenaw in air quality and water quality as compared to some of the rest of the state. But there are other factors, environmental factors also. For that matter, just the percentage of restaurants in an area that are fast food restaurants. Mm. That in and of itself has a major impact on health.
I'm speaking with writer Ron French. His reports this week in Bridge magazine, looking at the fact that health and wellness is certainly not evenly spread out in our state, and focusing today on the counties of Washtenaw and Wayne, literally side by side. And if you are a man living in Wayne County, you will probably, your life expectancy is 6 years shorter than the same guy living in Washtenaw County. I've got to wonder about the effect of living life with diminished expectations, where you come to a point where you see that everyone around you is struggling in terms of poverty and education and these issues you talked about, Ron, and why should you expect anything different? I've got to imagine that mindset must impact your overall health in a big way.
I think you're right. We spoke to a physician in Wayne County who said that exact thing, that if everyone around you is in poor health, you don't think it's a big deal if you are also in poor health. If perchance you are in Ann Arbor and all your friends are out bicycling and you can barely make it up the steps, you go to the doctor. We are so much a product of the people who are around us and what you're accustomed to, and what your expectations are for your life and for your health.
Now, how much you mentioned if you go to the doctor, how much does having or not having medical insurance figure into all of this?
It plays a major role. The uninsured rate. The percent of the population of Washtenaw County that is uninsured is 11%. That's the third best rate in the state. In Wayne County, it's 18%. Mm. Those are factors that tell you a lot about employment, tell you a lot about income. If you just do not have the money to go to a doctor, are you going to put it off as long as you can? And as I'm sure you know, the longer you're put off going to the doctor, often the more serious your outcomes are and the more costly they are.
As I read your piece, Ron, in Bridge, I kept asking myself, and I don't have an answer here, what is the takeaway? Because there has got to be something more than to the thrust of this piece than making people who live in Washtenaw feel pretty glad and folks in Wayne feel not so glad. What's the challenge for individuals and for policymakers?
That's a very good question. And I think the takeaway is at least in urban areas, the answer to this is not necessarily throw more doctors in the Detroit Medical Center. It is about education, because the higher education level, the better your health. The higher education, usually the higher income, and the higher income, the better your health. Really, to improve the health across the state, and I think this is what is instructive about Wayne and Washtenaw County,
mm-hmm.
you need to start. It's a long-term process. I think that to fix this, it's not a matter of hiring more doctors. It may be a matter of hiring more teachers or hiring different types of teachers. It's about getting more education.
And how much of this ties in with the idea of advocating for oneself? And what I mean by that in terms of residents of these counties being able to come out publicly and tell their elected officials and their elected representatives that these disparities are just not acceptable.
I think that will help. But you can't bring that up to policymakers until you know there's disparity. And that's what we're hoping to do here, is raise these issues so that the public actually knows that there are these massive disparities in health between a Wayne and a Washtenaw, and for residents to then go to their policymakers and say, hey, this is unacceptable. What can we do about it?
What most surprised you, Ron French, as you dug in and did the reporting to put this piece together?
The most surprising to me, Cynthia, was the difference in life expectancy, especially for men in the two counties. The life expectancy for males in Washtenaw County is the equivalent of Switzerland. In Wayne County, it's the equivalent of Syria. And these are counties that are right next to each other. I did not expect at all to see that type of difference. But all these little things add up. The higher rate of smoking, the higher rate of alcohol abuse, higher rate of obesity, it all adds up in the end to having a very different life expectation.
Give us a little preview, if you can, about what we're going to read later this week in Bridge as far as other areas of Michigan.
Well, we're going to be looking at a couple of things. One, we're going to be looking at some other factors, but we're also looking at other parts of the state. You'll see later in some Bridge coverage some vast differences in health factors between parts of northern Michigan and the rest of the state, where northern Michigan has a lot lower health outcomes than the rest of the state, while at the same time, those same areas have the highest rates of uninsured. And so you can draw your correlation there between those two.
Ron French is a contributing writer at Bridge Magazine. You can read his story on the health and wellness disparities between Washtenaw and Wayne counties online. Just go to bridgemi.com. Always a pleasure, Ron.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The rest of the country seems to be catching on to what Michigan beer lovers have known all along. Michigan was just listed as number 5 on USA Today's list of the 10 best craft brew states in the country. So it seems we're not only the Great Lakes state, we are becoming the great beer state. And the buzz around the growing microbrewery scene in Michigan has been amped up with news that the state's first mobile canning line is being launched. Now microbreweries around Michigan can get cans of their brew onto store shelves without having to invest in costly canning equipment. Joining me here in the studio is the co-founder of Michigan Mobile Canning, Andrew McLean. Good to have you with us.
I appreciate you having me.
Well, you had to be pretty cheered and probably saying, yes, I knew that, to hear the number 5 ranking, the USA Today list.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Michigan has definitely made its place nationally as the great beer state. It's a pretty exciting time to just be a Michigan beer drinker.
And how long has this been building? Like, where for the people who haven't been really following it closely, when did the rise in microbreweries begin and take off?
Certainly the boom, the big boom everyone's talking has been, you know, past 3 to 4 years. But Michigan has been steadily growing since the 90s. I mean, you had the early guys. Certainly Larry Bell is nationally known as one of the trailblazers in craft beer. We've had quite a few come along, and some of the biggest ones in the state have been here for quite a while. You know, maybe now they're just getting more of the attention because everyone's talking craft beer because it's such a growing industry inside Michigan where, you know, it doesn't necessarily have as many growing industries. This is a point of pride for a lot of people in the state.
So you are the co-founder of Michigan Mobile Canning. Explain how this works.
Yeah, my partner and I, Scott Richards, he's up in Traverse City. We've invested in a specially configured canning line. So it means it can fit on the back of a box truck. We arrive to the brewer's facilities and we can their beer for them. We'll bring, obviously, the equipment, but we'll also bring all the supplies, including pre-labeled cans. And we're doing it kind of a cool way to let them do smaller batches.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to a Crown or a Ball, the can you manufacturers, and let them know you want to can some beer, they're going to laugh at you if you don't have more than a truckload. We're talking like 200,000 cans.
Okay.
And it just doesn't work. It doesn't work for a lot of the guys that we want to work with. They can't make that kind of crazy upfront investment.
What kind of amount might they be talking about if you're a small microbrewery?
30,000 easily, just in cans alone. That's the cans, and then you have to find a spot to warehouse them until you're done using them. That's probably 5 years worth of cans, at least.
Oh, really?
For a lot of the guys we're talking to.
Okay.
So what we've done, we're working with the guys out in Colorado called Mobile Canning, the first in the country to do it, I suppose first in the world. And we're buying blank cans in bulk, and we're doing a sleeve label system where we'll get labels printed, affix them. It goes through a little heat exchange, so it wraps right around the can. It ends up being a very cool look, and they're able to do, you know, pay-as-you-go kind of thing. We'll just show up with all those cans labeled, and we're set to can the amount of beer they want.
How did you and your partner seize on this idea? I know you've been part of the beer scene for a long time.
Well, it's funny. My brother-in-law posted an NPR article on my Facebook page. You know, I read it, and I was like, wow, that's really cool. He knew I was a beer guy, and that's about as far as it went for about 3-4 weeks.
And what was the article?
It was about mobile canning industry.
In Colorado.
The guys out in Colorado and a couple of the other ones doing it out west. And I thought about it. I was like, wow, that's awesome. You know, that would work great for Michigan. 3 to 4 weeks later, I'm sitting here still thinking about it. I'm like, okay, I'm going to, at this point, have to convince myself it's a bad idea. I had never intended to start a business. But once I saw that and I knew what sense it made for Michigan brewers, it's something I had to look into. So I just started cold calling, cold emails the companies who were mentioned in the article. And the great thing about craft beer is they're happy to help. They take the call and they say, here's what we did. Here's kind of our process. A lot of other industries, I don't think you would see that kind of cooperation and sharing of information.
I was going to say, if you were even calling the big guys, the mega breweries, you would not be getting.
But craft beer is very much about the community and sharing information because they know that people aren't one brand loyal in craft beer. On macro beer, you have Bud guys and Miller guys and Coors guys. For whatever reason, they have that big brand loyalty. But you just drink great Michigan craft beer, and you don't stick to one. You try every different thing, and that's what's really cool about what's happening in Michigan is all the breweries work together because they understand all their clients are the same, and the more that they can work together, the better it is for all of them and Michigan craft beer in general. There's a lot of ways I think you could get into the craft beer business to try to make a little bit of money right now since it's growing very fast, but this is one that it was important to me to be able to help them in the process. I didn't want to just jump on and have a company that makes a quick dime. That doesn't make any sense for us. So what we're doing is we can help them grow and be a part of part of their growth, which is extremely exciting for us.
So you know the Michigan beer scene. What's your favorite Michigan brew?
That's the toughest part. It changes based on the weather. You know, we had a sunny day yesterday, and I'm looking for something very different than I was the day before when it was raining and you had a little bit of flurries. So it definitely changes day to day, and it changes. The great part is we have so much to choose from. You don't have to have a favorite because there are so many great ones.
Excellent and tactful. Very, very good.
I'm getting smart.
Andrew McLean, the co-founder of Michigan Mobile Canning, pushing Michigan's microbrewery scene to a new level. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I appreciate the time.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There probably isn't a parent around who has not had a child come home and write that classic school essay, "What I Want to Be When I Grow Up." And as our next guest proves, it might be very wise to pay close attention to that goal that child sets for himself or herself. When she was 10 years old, Caitlin Lynch of Bloomfield Hills announced her goal was to become a professional singer. She came from a family of very talented musicians. She had had her first solo in first grade at Holy Name School in Birmingham, singing "My Favorite Things" from The Sound of Music at the school talent show. She sang her way through Marion High School in Bloomfield Hills and then on to the University of Michigan. And this March, the ultimate dream became reality as Caitlin Lynch made her debut at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York in Francesca da Rimini. And she joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Caitlin, and congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Did you have a sense when you were a student here in Ann Arbor that you would see yourself on stage at the Met?
No, absolutely not. I remember going to the Michigan Opera Theater with my mother, actually, and watching Don Giovanni. I was 18, probably. These women up there doing the lead soprano roles were so spectacular, and I thought, this is such a distant dream. I'd never be up there. And then I actually made my professional operatic debut at Michigan Opera Theater in Don Giovanni. That was an enormous goal in itself. I never even thought as far as the Met.
You
didn't. It's so distant. Certainly, as my career progressed and I got managed, my management put me up for auditions for small roles and covers at the Met. You know, pretty early into my career, I think probably I sang for the Met for the first time, maybe in 2008. Mm-hmm. So then it becomes a little bit more of a reality that this is possible.
That you're actually getting sent on auditions.
Exactly. But there were a few auditions and a few no's, or maybe laters from them. And then just a couple of years ago, I did another audition and they offered me a couple of contracts. I never dreamed it to be possible, although I should mention that Lou Smella was our acting drama teacher at Marion High School. And she would take a big group of us girls to New York, and we'd go see Broadway shows, and we went on tour at the Met. We did a backstage tour at the Met. And I remember her coming to me and saying, we were in the dressing room area at the Met, "You might be here someday, Caitlin. Take this moment in. You could be here someday." And I just, you know, sort of got chills and thought this couldn't be possible. So then I was there, and it was possible.
You were walking in to rehearse. What was that like, to your first day of saying, "Here I am rehearsing for my debut at the Met"?
Well, the truth is I just had a baby in September, and so my mother was with me in New York. We got to New York a couple of days early so he would adjust. He was 4 months old when we got to Manhattan for me to start rehearsals. He didn't adjust. He wasn't sleeping at all.
Oh, dear.
And we were in a tiny one-bedroom apartment, so none of us were sleeping. The three of us were awake for the 2 days before rehearsal started. So I showed up at rehearsal.
On your last good nerve?
Well, it was, in a way, I'm sort of grateful for the circumstances because I wasn't able to even think about nerves. I was just getting there. I just had to show up awake and alert and do my thing. And so I didn't have the time or energy to think too much about my singing or think too much about how I looked that day. And in a way, that was sort of liberating and freed me up. And I had a great, great time. And the musicians are so fantastic. The other singers were just wonderful. So I was inspired the entire time. And I was learning so much in rehearsals from my colleagues. And the first time I walked out onto the stage was so exciting, but I had to play it cool because, you know, all my colleagues were around. And there was only one other singer in the cast who was making their debut. So I was sort of the newbie, the freshman on campus, so to speak. So I had to pretend like it wasn't such a big deal. It was just the Met. It's just this enormous, beautiful house that I'd been on the other side of that stage many times as an audience member.
Yes, and here you are looking out now at the house.
Different perspective altogether.
That you had to kind of keep to yourself.
Yeah.
Fill in the blanks for us, Caitlin, as far as getting from the University of Michigan. You were a voice major here?
Correct.
And then connect the dots. How does one build a career that can land them at the Met? Clearly there's talent, but there's a lot of hard work too. You didn't just land on that stage.
No, absolutely. Hard work, talent, and right time, right place, good support system. My path is individual to me. Everyone's is different. Mm-hmm. But I took a year off after I graduated with my Bachelor of Music from the University of Michigan, and I moved to Boston. And I thought, I've got to get out of Michigan. I've been here my whole life.
Mm.
Let's get some perspective. And I took time off of singing. I worked at a couple funeral homes in Boston and a Starbucks there. And I didn't sing. I'd been singing my whole life. My parents both sang. My grandparents sang. It was always just something I did. And I, at some point in my undergraduate studies, I didn't know why I was doing it anymore. I couldn't figure out if it was really what I wanted to do, if it was my dream or if it was just this expectation.
Like almost by default.
Exactly. Yeah. So I needed to take some time off, and I wouldn't even sing in the car with my CDs. They would play, but I wouldn't sing along, which was very unusual. It was like I just had to sort of shut that part down and see what happened. And about 6 months into that time, I was miserable, truly miserable. And I realized quickly that there was this void that had to be filled with music, singing. It was just something I couldn't not do. So as a senior at Michigan, I had gotten into the Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati, and they let me defer for the year to take the year off. And I thought, well, I probably won't go. You know, I don't know if I'm going to be a singer. And then after those 6 months, I was so grateful I had deferred, and there was a spot for me. So I started my master's in 2003. In Cincinnati at CCM, had a wonderful teacher there who sort of built me back up since I had taken so much time off.
Mm-hmm.
Things were rusty.
Yeah.
And he was so patient. Bill McGraw is his name. And I was there for 3 years. I did 2 years of a master's program and 1 year of an artist diploma in opera, and didn't finish the artist diploma because the Seattle Opera accepted me into their young artist program.
And a career can begin that way.
Exactly. So that was my first really professional engagement. And I had done so many auditions. I think it's interesting to note, I'd probably sent in 25 applications. You know, not everyone would even hear me. And I probably did 15 or 20 auditions, and one company accepted me into their program, and that was Seattle.
And there is a real lesson for hopefuls, young hopefuls, that you're going to hear no. You're going to hear no, but that doesn't
way
mean...
more than yes.
But it doesn't mean it can't happen,
exactly.
Whatever that dream is.
No, it takes one person to get your talent and take a chance on you. And for me, that was this wonderful director in Seattle, Peter Cazares. And also that same year, I was accepted into a summer young artist program at Glimmerglass Opera. And then I went on to make my main stage debut there a few years later in The Marriage of Figaro. So that is how it began. And when I was in Seattle, sort of life opened up to me in so many beautiful ways, and I met my husband.
And and now you are a new mommy, and
exactly.
And he is also a singer. So you can really share that, share understanding of what each other is doing that in a way that maybe an outsider wouldn't get.
Exactly. It's amazing that we have each other.
What are your thoughts on just the presence of arts classes and arts education in elementary and high school? Because we have so many districts in our state now with shrinking funding, shrinking enrollment, and eroding tax base, where you know they can take a look at that and say, you know what, we need to focus on the technology and the science classes
right.
at the expense of arts education. In your view, having benefited from that, what do youngsters get from arts education, even if they're not going to wind up on stage at the Metropolitan Opera?
Oh, my gosh, so much. I don't know what I would have done without it. Music class every week, all through elementary school, middle school, high school. I think about – I'm sort of going to answer the question in a backwards way. But having a career in opera, sometimes it's hard to keep perspective of what this really matters. How does it really matter? What does it really impact in the world to be a professional opera singer? It's certainly not brain surgery, not saving lives. However, I think that music and the arts are so healing and so powerful that it's important for me to take it so seriously, what I'm offering to an audience when I get up on stage. People have, you know, 2 or 3 hours to get an escape from their daily lives. I think that music is so healing. Why do we have baby Mozart CDs for little kids to listen to? You know, Vivaldi and Handel and Bach, these composers, obviously there's something in this music that is expanding children's minds, babies' minds. And in that way, I think that it's so crucial to be part of our public school systems, private school systems. I think the arts have to be better represented in our country. It's really, it's scary how they're disappearing.
Now you have got your Met debut under your belt. What's next?
Next, I go to Madison, Wisconsin. And then after that, I'm going to Seattle to do a world premiere by composer Jake Heggie, who's the most incredible composer and a man, with a company called Music of Remembrance. And I did a world premiere by him last year in Seattle, and this is sort of a continuation of that. And there's a recording that'll be made of the program. So I'm really excited about that. I've sort of had wonderful opportunities to be a part of new composers' works and creating a role for the first time.
So all of you are kind of the new guard in opera.
Exactly.
In a sense.
Yes. Yes, right. Jake as the composer and me as the singer. It's such an exciting collaboration. You know, sort of think about when Mozart was composing for his singers or Handel was composing for his singers, what that collaboration was like, and to sort of be a part of something so new and exciting and alive is thrilling. It's one of my favorite parts of my career to be able to sing new music.
And then looking forward to the Met?
Yes, I'll be back at the Met in the fall, in September. My baby will turn one in New York City, which is exciting. I'll be there doing another new opera by another young composer, Nico Muhly is his name. The opera's Two Boys. I will perform in the fall, November, in New York. And I did his another opera by Nico last year in New York, which was exciting, and then in Philadelphia. So it's another really wonderful collaboration for me to be working with him as well.
Michigan-born soprano Caitlin Lynch, it was great talking with you today on Stateside.
Thanks so much.
And to wrap up our conversation with Caitlin, here she is singing a traditional Irish song, Wild Mountain Time. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Rick Snyder says he's pleased with an official opinion from State Attorney General Bill Schuette. The legal opinion says the state constitution does not allow the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund to pay for dredging and other types of maintenance on public harbors.
As we look at, let's look out to the future, but I wouldn't expect to use the trust fund at all. That's not a place I would look at for resources for this.
The governor and the attorney general say the Natural Resources Trust Fund can only be used to acquire and improve property for the public's use. The governor and the legislature reached a compromise earlier on an emergency dredging bill, and that one taps into the Waterways Trust Fund and the state's general fund. That's for dredging this spring to clear harbors suffering from record low water levels. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now. So, Rick, help us understand the real implications of this opinion.
Well, like you just pointed out, that the governor and the legislature, some legislative Republicans who wanted to tap into the Natural Resources Trust Fund to pay for this emergency harbor dredging, that they found another way to go about it. But there's still this question of what might happen if the Federal Army Corps of Engineers backlog in dredging projects persists, for example, you know, what we might do going into the future. There's some legislation that's been introduced that would rewrite the rules for the trust fund to allow it to be used for maintenance, and so then it could be used for dredging. And what this says is that when the Natural Resources Trust Fund was created, and it comes from, the money comes from things like oil and gas leases on state land, that it's only to be used to acquire property, land, or water, or to do capital projects, you know, big one-time improvements and not for maintenance. And what this says is that dredging is basically maintenance, so it won't be used for that. And it's important to know that this is a formal attorney general opinion, and these are binding on state government. They have the force of law unless, in this instance, a judge overturns that interpretation.
So kind of tie this up for us then, Rick. Exactly where does this leave money for dredging the lakes?
Well, one of the things that the opinion says is that there are a lot of other places, that there are other trust funds, for example, that the state could look to take care of dredging projects. And, of course, there's always, if you decide it's important enough, that the legislature and the governor could go to sort of what is the state's main checkbook, the general fund, and appropriate money for the purpose. Obviously, the best case scenario would be that the Great Lakes water levels are restored to what they normally are, what they typically are, and that the Army Corps of Engineers also picks up the pace in dredging projects, and that maybe this won't be necessary to keep things ready for shipping and recreational boating in coming years.
Well, Rick, there's been a lot of talk about this emergency dredging because, as you said, the lake levels are just so low. But let's look down the road somewhat. What happens if this problem continues, and where would the money come from if dredging continues to be needed down the road?
Well, what the governor says is that is an unknown, but they would have to find something. It's just that in this case, you know, a lot of environmental groups, a lot of conservation groups were afraid that there's sort of this general movement in the legislature to put the brakes on property acquisition, and that one of the ways that they could do it and simultaneously deal with the harbor dredging emergency is go to the Natural Resources Trust Fund. And what this opinion says is that's not going to happen.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief, thanks so much for talking with us today, Rick.
My pleasure, Cindy.
You won't get much disagreement with the statement that one of the crown jewels of Michigan is indeed the collection known as the Great Lakes. And the future of the Great Lakes, their management, the usage, all of that was the focus of a forum that was held recently at MSU's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, zeroing in on the key questions. How should we manage these huge bodies of fresh water and do it in a way that guarantees they're available for future generations? Joining me is the Deputy Director of the University of Michigan Water Center, Jennifer Reed, and the Director of the Michigan Office of the Great Lakes, John Allen. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Want to have you give us a sense of what you see as the biggest threats that face the Great Lakes. I'll start with you, John.
Well, one of the threats facing the Great Lakes, obviously, is invasive species. Invasive species have been here. They've been here a long time. They've come in from a variety of different ways. Roughly over 180 species are now here. So managing the ones that we have here, making sure that we understand them and fighting them back where we can, but also making sure that we're closing all the doors to the invasion of new species. The big one that's on everybody's mind is Asian carp, and making sure that that doesn't show up. So it's a twofold problem. One, first we have to manage the ones that are here and the changes that they have brought to the Great Lakes. The other one is to make sure that we close the door on not having additional ones, including the carp, get into the Great Lakes.
I think the carp certainly is something that when you talk just to people who care at all about the Great Lakes, the idea that there's some little electric fence on a canal in Illinois possibly being the gateway to keeping them in or out doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. I don't know. Are we right or wrong in that sense, Jen?
Well, you know, I'm no expert on the Asian carp,
yes.
I'll just say. But I do know that that's not necessarily the only way they can get into the region either.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing we want to be thinking about when we're thinking about these invasive threats are all the various vectors and ways they can get in. You know, if they're coming in through shipping or organisms in trade or coming in through recreational boating activities, we just need to be aware of all the potentials and putting as much energy and effort into closing all the doors as we are have currently focused on Chicago. I mean, that's really heightening our awareness, and that's really important. But we can't just focus on that particular vector. We need to be thinking about other vectors as well.
I agree. I think the region has pulled together in understanding the threat that Asian carp present. And between the work that the Army Corps of Engineers is doing, the work that the states are doing, the work at the provincial and regional levels, are all very important, specifically as we talked about on the carp and their presence within the waterway systems coming up through the Mississippi River and into the Great Lakes. That is an avenue of threat that we have to be very diligent about and look at as many options as we possibly can. The work that the Great Lakes Commission, for instance, has done in highlighting management potential and ways to continue to make sure that we close that door. However, as Jen said, we do have to worry about the other pathways and other species that could come into the Great Lakes. And it's not enough just to attend to the one. It's good that the one is on everybody's mind, mm-hmm. but we have to realize that there are others and other threats. Current work recently between the United States Coast Guard and the United States EPA and the work of the states and the regions in harmonizing, working to harmonize their standards around ballast water, for instance, is another major piece that continues to work through the system, but one that we're very attentive to. Ballast water has historically been a big source of invasion or source of invasive species into the Great Lakes Basin. And we're pleased to see that the Coast Guard and the EPA has taken some good steps nationally to harmonize what would be a national set of standards around ballast water management.
So we're looking at a need for state policy, but also certainly national policy.
Well, let me put that in three bins.
Yeah.
The states have to do what the states need to do within their interest. Now, we have to make sure that we're doing that in harmony with the other states. Mm-hmm. So there is a relationship there on a state basis, state-to-state basis. But I'll add to that is also the regionality. These states are managed by eight states, by two provinces, by two national governments, and our what we do with Minnesota and Illinois is equally important to how we look at this resource with Quebec and with Ontario. And with both federal governments, we need to see, with all of our federal partners, we need to see this as a large collective system. A
lot of movable pieces
that
here.
We have obligations.
Yeah. Yes.
There are. It is complicated. You asked about sort of the biggest threats.
Yes.
And I think there's another threat that we need to be thinking about that we have less control of from, say, a state or provincial or regional level, but we need to respond to, and that's mm-hmm. climate change. And to me, that then puts into sort of context or a set of threats, and that's just how we as human beings are thinking about the Great Lakes and reacting to the Great Lakes and thinking not so much about managing particular issues on an issue-by-issue basis, but really thinking about how we ourselves as human beings interact with the lakes and what we do along the shore. Discharge into the lakes, discharge into the air, sort of thinking about how we manage our actions in relation to the lakes and the larger environment, as opposed to vice versa, thinking about how we manage the lakes themselves.
Mm. Yes. So where do you think we're at with that awareness and that self-awareness, maybe we should say?
I think we're starting to understand how important that is. If you look back in time over 100 years, we've seen the lakes vary a lot. And then we get to the point where the lakes are low or low below average, and then we're all surprised. They've been here before. They will be here again. They will be up again. We shouldn't be surprised when they're high again. What we have to make sure is we're building the interface of where humans are at that water's edge, which is so critically important in our ports and our coastal communities, building those interfaces to make sure that we understand how to build them in an environment that changes. The lakes aren't a fixed thing, and we build human systems around a fixed thing. We have to understand that these are dynamic, rising and lowering. One wonderful thing I think about in the Great Lakes, especially in our shallow parts in Saginaw Bay and in Western Lake Erie, as water level rises and lowers, it doesn't really just rise and lower, but it comes in and out. So for every, say, foot of rise or lower, it might expose 100 feet of beach. So think about these not as just up and down dynamics, but back and forth dynamics in the Great Lakes, and how profound that is.
And that affects so many things beyond enjoying the recreational right. side, but the economic side. If you rely on fishing to make right. a living, that's bad news.
That has historically been a very natural, very healthy function of the Great Lakes for mm-hmm. water levels to rise and lower,
right.
reestablish wetlands. What Jen's talking about is understanding from now and looking forward, what are those dynamics? What's changed about that?
Mm-hmm.
What else do we need to attend to? And how do we help people understand how to build infrastructure and build our lives at the water's edge that reflect the changes that we're going to be seeing?
and build expectations around that as well, so that you know, someone who purchases a home at certain level, maybe high lake levels or low, mm-hmm. and when those system change, as it will, go up or down, they're not surprised. That they have anticipated that that's going to happen. They recognize it's natural and that it's something that they can live with.
If you're just joining me, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, talking about essentially the future of the Great Lakes based on the fact that there was a recent forum held at MSU's Institute for Public Policy and Social Research exploring the Great Lakes. And I'm talking with the director of the Michigan Office of the Great Lakes, John Allen, here in the studio, and also the deputy director of the University of Michigan Water Center, Jennifer Reed. You're really covering many things such as pollution and development and cargo ship channels, so many things under the umbrellas of concerns. Apart from relying on public policy, what's your challenge to concerned citizens, to the people of Michigan listening to us talking, who care about the Great Lakes? What's our personal responsibility or course of action?
Boy, that's a big question.
It is.
because I think in order to answer that question, we need to know how educated the public is to really understand the system. Hmm. So I think it's easy just to say, you know, don't do bad things. You know, lawn fertilizer. There's a whole list of actions that, you know, are out there and people should be thinking about. But I really think that it behooves us who have the information to make it more available in ways that citizens can understand and provide them with actions that are going to have an impact. Mm-hmm. So it sounded like I just tossed off those other individual actions. Not really, but you need to understand why you're being asked to do those things and what the impact of your own changes you might make in your life have cumulatively. So we're talking about hundreds, thousands, millions of people making changes. The cumulative impact of those small changes is significant and does then end up in something that will be a better future for the region.
I'd like to frame it a little bit differently. So one of the ways that we think about this is, how do you move our belief, personal beliefs, in what has been historically such a water-rich region, in a place where we haven't had to think a lot about water or manage water in a way that really highlights its value.
Right.
I mean, given the fact that we have 20% of the world's fresh water here, tends to say it's probably a little less of value than where you only have a few drops or a couple of gallons a day. So part of it is really understanding, how do we change our belief in water as a ubiquitous, plentiful resource, and start to think about it in ways that say this probably has a little more value than we historically thought. How do I really think about it now as being a little more scarce or a little more valuable? How do I start to think about conservation in a very water-rich area? And this has been very difficult, I think, for a lot of people to understand. But you talked earlier about a lot of places in this country, and I'd say the world, have looked at the Great Lakes fairly longingly.
Yes.
And one of the things that we hear to a person throughout Michigan is, let's make sure our water stays here.
It's a mindset change.
It's a fundamental mindset change throughout the whole region.
It is, and it's going to take a lot of public education and a lot of understanding what motivates people to help them then make those changes.
And I guess from where you sit, as director of the Office of the Great Lakes, John Allen, your challenge to our lawmakers, our governor, our policymakers.
Well, one of the things we have to continue to think about is, what is the value proposition for the Great Lakes? What can they bring us that's unique to the region? What is our strategy around thinking about this as a valuable, phenomenal asset? What can we do unique that's here that can't be done somewhere else that may have a little less water? How important is waterborne transportation to the region? You mentioned that earlier. It's hugely important to our region. The world is more and more chasing calories, and by that I mean we're moving from 7 billion to 9 billion people over the next 20, 25 years or so. A statistic I heard fairly recently is, within that, 3 billion people worldwide will be entering the middle class. That is a staggering amount of expectation for food, agriculture. So what is the value proposition of that water in the Great Lakes in terms of servicing and supplying food to what is increasingly becoming a very hungry world. So I see great value looking forward in the Great Lakes. We need to understand how to utilize that, how to do that in a way that still works in harmony with healthy systems. The healthier the Great Lakes, the more economic value we can derive. These are deeply tie-barred together, and what we're doing is stitching back that relationship between a healthy economy and a healthy environment, but utilizing this phenomenal asset as we look ahead, and as we look ahead competitively with the world.
I've been talking with the director of the Michigan Office of Great Lakes, John Allen, and the deputy director of the University of Michigan Water Center, Jennifer Reed. I thank you both so much for being kind enough to join us in the studio today.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And here at Stateside, we look forward to connecting with you. It's easy. Find us online. Just go to michiganradio.org, and you can click on the Stateside link. Go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, or we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Mercedes Mejia. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3.